Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hi guys, I'm Jamie Oliver and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. How amazing. For the past decade, they've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and so much more. It's been 10 years and they're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Rare Book Room. My name is Cynthia, and I help direct the events here at Strand, where books have been loved for 91 years and counting. Tonight, we are very excited to have with us Jacqueline Raposo for the launch of her book, The Me Without. Jacqueline has written over 400 stories covering every topic, including food, lifestyle, entrepreneurship, tech, art, medicine, and more. As the producer and co-host of Love Bites Radio, she studies why and how we love in all forms. And with decades of chronic illness stemming from Lyme disease and myalgic, and I'm going to butcher that, and another disease behind her, she advocates with others as the co-founder of the hashtag MarchingWithMe campaign and a chronic illness essayist. Joining Jacqueline is writer and the creator of the Lonely Hour podcast, Julia Bainbridge. Three-star chef for the restaurants Missy and Lilia, from Pete Wells of NY Times, and James Beard Best Chef of New York winner, Missy Robbins, and senior editor at Food and Wine and author of the book High Anxiety, Kat Kinsman. Tonight's event will also feature alcohol-free cocktails by Listen Bar and themed desserts by Le Chouchou executive pastry chef Daniel Schernick. And special thanks to our ASL interpreter, Kat Dunhams. Please join me in welcoming Jacqueline, Julia, Missy, and Kat to Strand.
Look at all these gorgeous people who care about self-care. This is a lovely, lovely thing. Would you all indulge me for just a second? And if you feel comfortable with this, close your eyes because we're gonna breathe. And it's gonna be very simple. And when I tell you to breathe in through your nose, breathe in as deeply as you can, and then breathe out forcefully. We're gonna do this three times. So breathe in through your nose, hold it, out through your mouth. In through your nose, out through your mouth. One last time in through your nose and push this out through your mouth. You can keep your eyes closed or you can open them. When's the last time you deliberately breathed like that? We don't give ourselves a chance to do that. We don't give ourselves a chance to take care of ourselves, to listen to our bodies, or at least some of us didn't. Until one person took an entire year to figure out where the noise in her life was coming from and how to really listen to herself and take things apart piece by piece to really find herself and find what was important to her and what she could discard. And this all came together in the form of an incredible book called The Me Without. So welcome to all of our panelists, to our beautiful author, and let's get started talking about a little bit of self-care and how we are good at it or not, and it's okay if we're all on different paths about that. But let's start out. Wait, oh, I was on the wrong page right there. So you went through a whole process of getting rid of things, of maybe taking on new behaviors, but mostly getting rid of maybe some cluttery things in your life. Social media was a big one that you decided to cut out for a while. Can we talk about the benefit or risks of doing that, especially when you're a person who's a writer, somebody who has to live in the public eye, or a chef who needs people to come into the restaurant? How do you give that up? What does that do to your perception of yourself?
Anyone else want to start?
That's you.
I think so many of us in creative, not necessarily creative fields, but I definitely felt like I had to be a brand on social media as both a writer and a radio host, and I sort of started feeling lost to this two-dimensional world. And it wasn't as fun as the conversations that I could have been having, as the stories I could have been writing. And I really thought that, oh, my work is gonna suffer if I'm not branding myself, if I'm not pushing myself. And after 40 days of social media cleansing, or whatever you want to call it, I really found out that's not true. I really think that we build these systems that we create, we build these cultures that we create, and I think a lot of people are going to disagree with me on this, but I don't think we have to be on social media if we don't want to be. If you found out this about this event on social media, I've been pushing it a lot on social media the past couple of weeks. So I obviously still do use social media, but one of the women that I interview in the book, Amber Case, said as long as social media is a tool that we are using, that it is not using us, then that's sort of like a healthy relationship in that way. That is sort of how I try to keep myself in check for that. But I think social media is still one of my biggest problems with self-care, with self-identity. And I think a big part of that was breaking from the idea that I had to be on it. I have a choice of how I work online and who I am and how I present myself, and I still have to check in with that, and that's part of my self-care routine. But it was a really hard one to break, and it's something that I still have to spend a lot of time being very aware of. Otherwise I can easily fall back into endless scrolling without noticing.
Can I make a case for underscoring not using it?
Yeah.
I'm going to read something. Can I read something?
Please.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So there's this concept of psychological asymmetry. It's something that British philosopher Alain de Botton came up with, and I'm going to read what he wrote about it. It's not too long. Just bear with me for a sec. He said, "One of the most basic facts about the human condition is that we know ourselves from the inside, but we know others only from what they choose or are able to tell us," right? Which is a far more limited and edited set of data. We're continuously and intimately exposed to our own worries, hopes, desires, and memories, many of which feels overwhelmingly intense, strange, vulnerable, or sad. Yet when it comes to other people, we're tightly restricted to knowing them through their public pronouncements, right? So the hints and clues we're left to play with are hugely imperfect guides to the reality of another person's existence. And the result of what we term this psychological asymmetry is what we almost always think of ourselves as far more peculiar, shameful, and alarming than other people we run into. So the idea that, like, we're not really so odd, we just know a lot more about who we are, right? And I bring it up because, like, those public pronouncements that he mentioned, man, are they, like, are there exponentially more of those being made now that we're performing out our lives on social media? So, you know, the natural psychological asymmetry that we all experience becomes even more warped for the Instagram user. So, like, even if we know that most people's lives involve anxiety and distress, just like ours, despite those things not being reflected on their feeds, it's so easy to believe otherwise, right? All of that is a roundabout way of saying unfollow, unfollow, unfollow. You know, that's getting to the care part of your question. Like, I've unfollowed people that I like in real life because of the way that things come across on their social media channels. They make me feel like a failure by comparison. And like, do I need to work on not comparing myself to other people? Yes, but that will take some doing. So in the meantime, I can control this. So the minute that, like, what you're getting from following a certain person changes from enjoyment or enrichment to some form of feeling bad, cut it out.
I love the mute button. It's such a beautiful gift you can give yourself. It's just muting annoying things. They don't have to know. It's less violent than, I don't know what happened there. It's less violent than blocking. Just muting somebody and they'll never know. They could be talking at you for the rest of time and they don't know that you're not listening anymore. It's a beautiful
It's more
thing.
Gentle than an unfollow, I guess. Yeah. Mute.
Yeah.
I think you just have to decide what you want your relationship to social media to be, starting with your own feed. And I think for me, I didn't kind of obviously grow up in social media. And in my last restaurant job, social media was just getting really popular and I didn't really understand it. And when I went to open Lilia, my business partner, who's 10 years younger than me, came to me and said, you know, you better up your profile a little bit. And I was like, huh? I was like, I don't really want to. And it's taken me a solid 4 years to really kind of get into it, but I kind of gotten into it on my own terms. And I don't post a lot about personal stuff. And I use it as a tool to kind of promote the restaurant and get people mostly excited about either what we're doing or I think the most success I've had with social media is when I've traveled and posting things about where I've been, and I've gotten the most feedback from that of like, is that going to go on your menu? Are you, tell us where to go in Rome? So I think what I've learned about it is if you use it in a way that you're comfortable with and that excites you, it is actually a helpful tool and it creates a really nice community around you.
Yeah, I think there's a very generous way to use it where you're including people, where you're saying to people like, hey, here's the thing I want to share with you, as opposed to like, well, look what I'm doing here in the Caribbean, or you know, whatever it happens to be. You're inviting them in on that thing, and I think especially if you can convey it with a sense of how lucky you are to be experiencing this, it's a really generous thing. Missy, I want to stick with you for a second here, because we were talking about defining moments when you knew that you had to make a change of some sort. I think each of us has had a moment where we realize like, this isn't working anymore. Brain isn't working so well, relationships, body, whatever it happens to be. And there needs to be a change made.
You made a big change.
Which one would you like to talk about, Kat?
Well, I'm thinking of—
There are many.
Yes, but you were talking about switching—
Leaving my job.
Yeah, switching restaurants and walking into the void like you did.
Yeah, I think for me, I had been in this career as a chef for 20 years, and I was 42 years old, I think, and I was in a position where I had an amazing job and an amazing salary and all the press in the world and accolades and a great team, and I wasn't happy. And I think it took me a really long time to sort of accept that and to recognize it. And I was in a position where I decided that I could afford to take a year off, and which wasn't necessarily the smartest financial decision, but from a mental perspective, it was amazing. But I was becoming sort of this person that I didn't like. I wasn't happy. I was not physically fit. I was 40 pounds overweight, and I just knew that if I went from one job to another job, that it wasn't going to kind of solve any of the issues. So I made a very conscious decision to not work for a year. And I sort of said, and I thought I'd last 3 months because I was a workaholic for many, many years. And I just thought I'd kind of take the summer off and enjoy it and go back to work. And then I realized it was really fun to be unemployed. And I was actually very, very good at it. And I found another skill. And I took that time to really figure out what I wanted to do and who I wanted to do it with. And the result of that is my first restaurant, Lilia, which just turned 3 years old. And Lilia, and I say this all the time to people, Lilia would not be Lilia if I hadn't taken the time off, because my mentality changed, how I wanted to run a restaurant changed, how I wanted to interact with my staff changed, how I cooked really changed quite a bit over that time, and it became a much, much different kind of Italian cuisine than I had been cooking before. And so I think a lot of good came out of that, and I wouldn't be where I am today if I hadn't taken that time.
Yeah, and I've been a fan. This keeps going out. I've been a fan of hers this whole time.
time at all of the restaurants.
I think she's my first fan ever.
Her restaurant was a couple floors below my office, so I had the pleasure of getting to have her food on a regular basis, and I loved it with every cell in my body then, and then to watch this evolution, I think
the care that you have given yourself shows up in your
food in a really meaningful way. So
thank you.
So, Julia, you have
uprooted yourself. Thanks. Talk about some of these bold decisions that you have made to care for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, a big one is truly coming to the determination that alcohol does not serve me. At least not right now. So I've removed alcohol from my life for periods of time before, usually after over drinking led me to scary places. So not drinking was a reaction to like shock or shame. And this time it's really different, and it's like it's tied up with another change I made, which is to come back to New York. So after 10 years here, I had moved to Atlanta for a job, and the job was great, and I sometimes regret leaving it now that, you know, so many in media are losing work and the industry has become more unstable than ever. But Atlanta wasn't my town. I met some wonderful people there, but I had built myself like a whole world in New York, and something about being in my mid-30s now, I'm more aware of time, and I don't want to spend any more of it away from my people or from the place that gives me a sense of mooring. And I think like drinking's tied up with that because the stakes are higher now. Like, I want to show my friends, some of whom are in the front row there, how much I value them, and I wanna figure out what my career looks like if I determine that full-time media, you know, work isn't sustainable, and I'll only succeed at those things if my heart and mind are clear. So alcohol doesn't help me in that endeavor. So I really like don't want to drink.
Yeah. And yeah, we get the benefit of these beautiful non-alcoholic cocktails.
Thanks to places like Listen Bar.
Yeah.
That are serving me and us. Yeah.
And Jacqueline,
people who
will all read and love your book are going to know about some of your reasoning behind taking care of yourself and why you had to put that at the center of your world.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think most of my life, every time I've had to make a change, it was because of my health. I've grown up with health issues, and they've sort of morphed and changed as I've gone into adulthood. And so most major changes I've made, whether it's been leaving a job, shifting a career, changing a home, have been because I've sort of like the bottom has dropped out. I'm also an overworker, and that usually comes like overworking before the bottom drops out, and then I have to make a change. But the book sort of, I had thought that I had caught myself from the bottom dropping out. I'd quit a cooking job, actually, the only cooking job I've ever had. I was a private cook on top of food writing, because again, workaholic, and food writing does not always pay bills, so I was doing sort of both. And so I'd quit that job like 2 years before the story of the book starts, and thinking that like, okay, the bottom won't drop out, I'll be okay. But then I found myself like still sick, and I was working to fix my health, and it wasn't getting better, even though I was changing my lifestyle again and again, and my finances weren't getting better because now I'd quit the good money job. And I had this podcast about dating where my co-host Ben and I were going out and dating a lot and interviewing people about love and what
like
worked,
me, I was
like Julia
I dated
and
a lot.
Kat.
I date a lot.
Missy was busy. She had her restaurant. And so we were just asking people about love and what was working and not working. And I was going out on a lot of dates and it wasn't happening. And so I think, so this change just actually came from it not being good enough. I was like happy-ish, but like I couldn't keep on working to fix it. And later I interviewed Julia for the book, and she said something that just sort of really stuck. It was like, sometimes you just get over yourself. And that's sort of just where I started. Like I was just frustrated. It was social media that started it, but I was just sort of frustrated with both not with being sick, single, and broke, and nothing moving forward. The bottom didn't drop out and nothing was going forward enough. And I was like, well, if I can't keep on adding stuff, then I'm gonna start taking away stuff and just see what happens. But I was just not, the status quo wasn't enough. Something had to change. And so I tried this weird thing, yeah.
So we're all people who, I think all four of us are people who, something is going wrong, we throw work at the problem. because that's how we, you know, define ourselves and find a value and maybe have been rewarded for it too much in the past. Like, oh, you've overachieved. Here's more. And, you know, and here you have you have done X amount of things, and, you know, in your head you calculate, oh, you know, I have this amount of worth because of all the things I have done. It's incredibly terrifying to take time to not produce, to just stop and maybe sleep, maybe take a day off, maybe do something where you're not producing. I've had to go through a change over the past couple of years because I've had some physical problems, and I had to go to bed at a normal hour and not be on social media or writing or doing any of these other kinds of things. I've had to say no to doing a certain amount of things. And I've gotten a little bit calmer about the notion that, no, I don't have to, you know, write something every day. I don't have to have one palpable thing that I have created every day. And that is scary as heck to me. Or it was. I'm getting a little bit better about it now. How do you get to that point where you realize, like, it is okay to rest and opt out and don't go to that party and maybe take that nap? How do you give yourself permission to do that?
I think it's the most important thing in the world is what I learned is just to have balance. And it's such an overused topic these days, and having balance, having balance, having balance. But for me, it was one of the things I learned when I wasn't working. And I was at a point when I wasn't working that I wasn't even sure if I wanted to be in the restaurant business, which is really sad because it's all I had done, and I just was so burnt out on it. And I realized that if I was going to go back into the business, that it had to be on my own terms. And part of those own terms were creating balance. And that didn't mean not working hard and not producing. It just meant doing it in a different way, but also really allowing myself and trying to promote that in my teams also the space to do other things, whether that's work out every morning, whether that's go get a cup of coffee in the morning and sit with the paper, whatever it means to you as an individual. For me, it meant non-negotiable Pilates sessions and working out and being okay going to lunch with a friend because I'm at the restaurant most of the time at dinner, and recognizing that I didn't need to be in the kitchen from 10 a.m. until midnight every day. And I think it's actually made me much more productive to not be there as much, but to always sort of have it on my mind, but be able to also just delegate to other people who want to feel empowered. My team doesn't want me standing in the kitchen all day. They love me, but they definitely don't need me standing over them all day. So I think empowering other people that work around you and surrounding yourself with other people allows you to be productive in just different ways.
Julia, how do you slow down?
I mean, I've never really considered workaholism to be a virtue. That may be due to my parents, who were, I guess some would say absent, but some would say like didn't put pressure on me to go to, like, you know, practice before class and then write my screenplay between homework and bed and all the things that younger millennials, I think, deal with, the pressure from their parents who are so concerned about their economic prospects. But I'm kind of in that period right now where I've slowed down a little bit, and I don't think I can do this forever, but I'm like, I'm a little nervous about the lack of work I'm producing right now. I'm working on some longer lead projects, and but I don't know. I'm really investing right now in me. I've just moved back to New York in November. I'm trying to do it the right way, reconnect with my people, and sort of make decisions slowly. And I'm investing in, I'm sort of like muscling up with some tools to help me enjoy my life more and better navigate its challenges. And that means like twice a week I'm going to Midtown from Brooklyn, which takes an hour each way, which is not something I can do when I have a demanding full-time job, to go to therapy and also take coursework in something called dialectical behavior therapy, which teaches you like distress tolerance and interpersonal effectiveness. And like, I literally have a workbook that I'm working through to figure out how to better communicate and treat myself. So I think I'm I've made it a priority. I'm not totally comfortable with it. I'm trying to be so that I reap the best benefits from this time that I have that's pretty unusual in my life.
It's hard, man. It's hard. So let's talk about how you went from, you know, being producing. What's the language you use in your head to have a moment of like, hey, I need to slow down now. It's okay if I take this nap. It's okay if I'm kind to my body that's telling me it needs a rest.
To be brutally honest, right now, since writing the book, I am far sicker. And so right now, resting and self-care, resting and not working isn't self-care, it is survival. I'm not really working right now. I turned in my last food stories, one right before the holidays, one right after. I don't go out ever. This is the second time in probably the last year I've been in a room with more than 10 people. Like you asked that question, I started gripping my cup. My self-care around this is curbing my jealousy when I go on social media and see other writers and their stories coming out, or a lot of my food media friends in this room and seeing them at events or seeing what they're doing, and curbing my fear of having value as a person if I can no longer write, because my illness continues to, it's gotten worse in the last year, and I have hope and I have a medical team and I'm going to get better than I am right now, but writing a book and producing and promoting a book is physically exhausting. So I have hope, but my resting is my job. I did an event on Thursday and I rested Friday, Saturday, and yesterday. I was laying down all day and I will go home tonight and lay down, and I will be lying down all day tomorrow. So my situation is very abnormal, but I agree when I sort of, when I think about this idea of resting and doing less, that A, when I am in any sort of production mode, because I'm not completely out for the count with work, that I do still have to force myself to look at turning off. Like I was still yesterday while I was lying down writing emails and now and then doing social media stuff. So I'm not like entirely not working, obviously. So I have to remind myself that, okay, after in this period, you're going to take 3 days and not do anything that involves work, meaning no computer and no phone, because when you do turn off and take care of yourself, then you are more productive. So I entirely agree with that. And it's so good to do that. And I also wish that we do not have to be in pain all the time to do this for ourselves. So I know there are people in this room who live in bodies similar to mine and we're in unique situations, but I really do think that being kinder to ourselves, listening to our body, spending the time to learn how to understand what our body is saying to us, loving our bodies for the beautiful things that they do for us, giving them some more attention, and then making those choices to be nicer to them, even when they work for us, is just, we'd all be healthier and happier and contributing beautiful work to the world if we did that a little bit more.
No, that was an exceptionally generous answer, and I am extra grateful that you are in this room right now. And you were saying you think it's rare or odd. I think there are so many people out there who are living in these bodies and living in their brains that make it hard to be this heap of meat in the world. And it's, but we don't talk about it as a society so much. We're not awesome about that. Dealing with physical stuff over the past year, it's overcoming a certain amount of mortification to talk about it.
One of the things I love to remind myself and other people in my community is that we have no idea what the person in front of us is feeling inside. So like, yeah, I'm a person who, I don't look like a sick person. And so neither does the person in front. I have no idea if the person in front of me is if they're in as much pain as I'm in. And I try to remember that. I have no idea what their body's story is. And so I just try to somehow be somewhat, I mean, I'm an interviewer, so that helps, but I try to be an open conversation for other people. That's why we've all had conversations about our health and bodies over the time I've known these people. And I just think the more, we can talk about it and create space to admit that we all live in bodies, and living in a body is hard.
Being a person in the world is a really hard thing to do. And then we all, four of us, we're in the food world somehow, whether it's a writer, a chef, whatever it happens to be. And for some of us, food is the problem. Like for me, I'm a food writer and editor, and so much of my physical stuff is tied up in a nasty gut issue that makes eating painful and hard. And that's a, you know, that's a negotiation that I've had to go through, and my sort of self-care has been telling people about it. Hey, I can't actually eat that thing. Oh, I'm in a period where I can only eat like these sort of few things. And the more that I have shown that from myself, the really people have been lovely and kind and caring about it. How have you all sort of negotiated when food or drink or whatever it is bringing the loveliness and the lightness and the happiness and the community and all that good stuff to it versus when it's not doing those things?
I mean, I think for me, the food issue, I'm very lucky not to have gut things and stuff, but the food issue is definitely an eating issue, which is ironic when you're a chef. And I definitely have a tendency to have weight issues, and it's something that I have to deal with every single day when I wake up. And I went on Weight Watchers to lose 40 pounds when I wasn't working, and it was really easy to do it when I wasn't working, and it really changed the way I cook and the way I think about food, and that's been translated into both of the restaurants in terms of how much fat I cook with, and I still cook with fat, don't worry, and I obviously own 2 pasta restaurants, so that hasn't gone away, but I personally wake up every day and I think about how to attack the day from an eating perspective to maintain my weight. And that's really challenging. And it took me so many years to recognize that I was just like an overeater. I never saw myself becoming big. And I stepped on the scale one day and I was almost 200 pounds. And I was like, how did I get to this? And so I think, I spend a lot of time really consciously thinking about it. And I know also that when I eat healthier, I feel much better. And when I don't eat healthy, I feel terrible. So it's just, for me, a constant reminder. And I'm never going to give up eating the foods I love. I've just really spent the last several years training myself of how to eat those foods in moderation and how to make them sort of celebratory things instead of like going to Joe's Pizza every day and getting a slice, or eating a bite of pasta instead of 3 bowls of pasta. And I have to taste a lot of food. Most of my job at this point is tasting and making sure my team's doing what they need to do. And I've just learned how to do it in a different way. And when I feel myself kind of going in a not great direction, I just do like a hard stop and reset, and kind of, I don't do cleanses and things, but I definitely just start eating really, really healthy for a few weeks and kind of get back on track.
I feel really lucky. There's never been a better time to be a non-drinker. Like, Lorelai, thanks for bringing these drinks. I mean, I think like, so the popularity of Dry January, like you've got so many people being more mindful about their drinking, whether or not they've struggled with substance abuse. And the more that I talk about not drinking, the more curiosity I get from people, other people who have like negotiated their relationships with alcohol, people who are really into kombucha and tea and all these other delicious things we have to drink. I just feel like we're all kind of celebrating those things right now. It's fun.
Yeah. I started off of both like gluten and dairy when I was a kid. So it's been like 20 plus years because of my health issues. And that's actually why I went into food writing, because when I was younger, I was like, I either have to learn more about food or I'm going to hate food. And so now you can get obviously gluten, dairy free, everything. So with restaurants, it obviously makes it hard. Now I can eat less, but just because of where my health is. So it makes conversations hard. And I've got speeches when I go to restaurants where I don't know people, and I get very nervous still with talking to waiters. I have a whole joke, like I've got this whole layers, like I make it funny and really like, you know, nice, but also serious, and talk about vomiting and that kind of stuff, just so, like, they know that I'm serious, but I'm also trying to be nice about it. But like, I am also very lucky that I work with chefs, and they are awesome because they care about food. They love food even more than I do. And I love food. I love gluten, even though I can't eat it. I would eat the crap out of gluten. I've got like, my apocalypse meal is down. It is like beer and cheese pizza. Nothing on it, like mozzarella cheese pizza and a lot of beer, and I'm gonna eat so much of it as like the asteroid's coming. I can wait. I was gonna say I cannot wait, but like obviously I can wait. obviously I can wait for the asteroid. But like, that's what I would have. And it's, but like, chefs love food. And so some of the best, most beautiful conversations or moments that have struck me off guard are when I'm in a restaurant finishing an interview and I'm offered something to eat. And I was like, no, I don't eat on interviews because I have these food issues. And a chef will say just the most beautiful gift of like, oh, well, let me make this for you. Like, you should, of course I want to make something for you to eat. Or once I went to a press dinner for 12 and the chef had made an entirely separate meal, course for course, even getting gluten-free crackers from this place in Brooklyn and bread for me. And he didn't have to do that. And another one had said, well, of course, like, of course I want to cook for you. Chefs, we take care of people. We feed people. Like, the chefs that I get to work with, they cook because they want to feed people. They love food and they love to feed people. So, yeah, it makes my job hard, obviously, but I don't review food. And I talk to people. I talk to people who make food. And that's a pretty awesome, awesome job to get to have. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the negotiation I've had to make. I'm for the most part not writing about the food, I'm writing about the people. And I switched jobs recently and somebody said, what are you the senior editor of? And I was like, feelings. And those to me are the more interesting things. I mean, for me, the social negotiation of food has been a little bit difficult. I mean, my husband's here in the audience and he can say, like, we stopped going to restaurants for about a year. And because I didn't want to be the girl at the table who was saying, well, you know, here's the thing. But once I started actually talking about it, people were so incredibly kind. The chefs were kind. My friends were kind. They realized I make the jokes too, because I always say, like, well, I'm not going to die. It's not anaphylactic. I'm just going to probably barf and feel gross later. Or you won't
kill me.
Yeah, that's the thing. So you won't kill me.
Nobody will kill me.
Yeah, I'm just going to feel like crap later. And then they're like, I don't want you to feel like crap with my food. I want to feed you. I want to make you happy. So, I mean, I am very lucky that I have been in a privileged position where I've been able to be really open talking about all of this kind of stuff. And not everybody has that privilege and luxury. So I figure I'm really grateful to be up here with three other people who do that. Let's talk about what self-care looks like for each one of this. I'm fascinated by it because culturally, there's this notion that people have been talking about self-care, and so much of it is this bizarre marketed version of it where you assume it's mani-pedis and spa visits and stuff, which it can be. And that's a great thing, but I'm really coming to realize it means a whole lot of different things to different people. What does it look like for each of you? Let's say the 10-minute self-care version and then the more larger holistic version of it.
Oh, you want me to start?
We've been having a good
If you like it that way, okay, great. I mean, for me, again, it just goes back to balance, and I know it's about incorporating working out. It's a lot about sleep for me, and making sure that I get enough of it, and listening to my body. I think you talked about that, and knowing, like, when I'm really tired, to just, like, take a moment, and I don't have to keep pushing myself, and the restaurant's not going to close because I leave 3 hours early one night. And I think just, like, recognizing where you are in life. And but for me, it's about eating well and working out and sleeping, and, like, also having a social life and surrounding myself with people outside of work and outside of the restaurant business, and having a little bit of diversity there as well has become pretty important to me also.
Julia, what's that look like?
I'm going to start with, like, a sort of silly example, which is, like, bringing these papers, and you know, it's like, I knew I would be nervous talking in front of a group of people tonight, and when I get nervous, I tend to become unfocused, so having an outline to reference here, like, even if it looks kind of silly, makes me feel more secure. And the reason that falls under self-care is that if I were given this opportunity to share this space with you all, and I went home feeling like I got lost and didn't contribute anything of value to ticket-buying attendees of this event, I'd probably sleep poorly because I'd be beating myself up, and I'd spiral into a bit of depression that would last a couple days, and it would affect my other work. And so I bring notes. So that's one thing. And that falls in line with what self-care means to me at this point of my life. Like, of course, there's the more immediate self-soothing kind of self-care, like baths and candles, and I'm super into those. But right now, self-care is work. Like I'm playing a longer game, and I've prioritized the things I mentioned earlier, like therapy and those classes. And it's kind of digging in. I guess like if I had to really boil things down, the goal of that work just like sounds so sort of overly romantic, but I mean, to lead my life with love instead of fear, and to and the way to do that is to bolster my self-worth. And so that's what I'm doing.
And yay notes.
Yeah, notes.
Yeah. Jacqueline.
My 10-minute self-care is just giving myself time to think. I think it goes with the whole, like, we're all so busy and the world is very distracting. So for me, the 10 minutes would be like the breathing and thinking, like, how do I feel right now? What do I want right now? What is coming up right now? Am I making the best choices? Do I want to be doing what I'm about to do? Or do I think I have to be doing what I'm going to do? What can I take off of my schedule? It's just sort of like the check-in, because if I don't, a time can go by and I'm making not great decisions. So I think that's my constant check. My constant self-care is just making sure I am in control. Not control, that's not a great word, but I'm aware of my thoughts and my feelings and my choices versus my, how would you put it? Just like the, you know, living without awareness of what I'm doing. And then everything else, it really is the work that I did. It was a really hard year, but it really connected me to my values and my priorities in life. And so even though like I'm technically limited right now physically, and that is a job and that is very hard and that can emotionally be very hard, I know my priorities and my values and what makes me happy, and a lot makes me happy. And so self-care is reminding myself in those 10 minutes, or sometimes very longer than 10 minutes, to focus on those. And that means focusing on the books that make me happy, the people that make me happy. I don't get to see many people. And so when I do, I make sure that I'm present with them, and I prioritize the people that this body does well with, and they take care of me, and I try to take care of them, and nature, and my, you know, dogs and birds, but the things that fortify me and make me happy and that feed me. And so those things are my self-care. And so I can have a very whole and, I mean, happy isn't the goal, but like, you know, just a very content human existence, because I'm living by what right now at least are my values, my priorities, the things that are sustaining me, I guess. Yeah.
Well, a lot of my self-care these days has been giving myself the time to read, to put my phone into airplane mode. I read a lot of books on my phone, which is probably not the best way to do it, but here's where we are. I forgive myself for that. I put it in airline mode and I read books. And I have to say that reading your book was such a tremendous gift of calm. Like, I worried for you during parts of it.
It got dark.
It did, but it's such a gift of a book and a story of a really hard journey to becoming a person who is kinder and more accepting of yourself and your limitations and things. So self-care is reading, and I think self-care for a lot of you over the next couple of days should be to read this book that she gave the world as a gift, and which brought all these people into the world.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, do we have time for any questions, or do we want to take a couple questions? Okay, so I think somebody have a microphone.
We've lost our mic. That's our.
Oh shoot!
Well,
okay.
We can share. Yeah.
Okay. If anyone has a question, you can put your hand up.
Oh, I see a hand in the back. Hi, Deborah.
I'm wondering, Kat, I think in our industry there are a lot of people who come to you who are struggling, but when you see people who are struggling, especially people who are loved ones in your life who don't quite know how to ask, but you don't want to like push ideas onto them, how have you addressed that? People in your life you love and who kind of need some self-care and are just starting that journey.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, I mean, what she's sort of referring to is I have a sort of side project where I talk to chefs about mental health and taking care of themselves, and chefs are notoriously masochistic, so it's really hard sometimes for that to happen. There's a couple different degrees of it. If I'm really worried about somebody, I just have the conversation and say, I'm worried you're hurting yourself, that you're going to hurt yourself, you know, or do you need to tell me something, or, you know, what can I do for you? And just, because the alternative to that is not a good one. So you can have a really blunt conversation. I got trained as a crisis counselor, so I could ask that question in the proper way. Otherwise, I will ask people to breathe with me. I will send them, there are a few gifts that I send out to people that sort of you breathe along with that. And it's a really important thing to do to be able to clear your head. I don't know how you all felt at the beginning when you had that little breath, but it's a, you know, it's a really good thing to be able to do it. I talk really openly about going to therapy, about times when I'm in a really bad personal spiral, to normalize it so people know that they're not broken if they're dealing with those things. But I have a dear friend, and I'll hand this over to you guys in a second. I have a dear friend who checks in on me when I have not been on social media much or have not been responding to his texts. And we call it being down at the bottom of the well. And we're just like, oh, just shining a flashlight down the well. No need to respond if you can't or don't want to or whatever right now. Just know I'm up here. I can shine a flashlight down. But I'm here with my hand if you ever want to crawl out. And we do that for each other on a regular basis. So those check-in texts are huge. Just ask people. You can say to somebody, hey, you know, no need to respond if you can't right now. That's a good gift to be able to give to somebody. But just, I'm thinking about you. I'm here if you need me. I care about you. And if you need to talk, I'm here to hear what's the real answer. You don't have to hide anything from me. How about you guys?
I love the Mr. Rogers. He gave a speech to save PBS, and he said that just that teaching children specifically that feelings are mentionable and manageable. I think that's sort of just opening that conversation. I just try to help people talk about their feelings and sort of just figure out with different gentle, non-imposing ways to be like, how are you feeling around something? And I think that's sort of just that we can talk about feelings without them being scary is a way, just to sort of lessen the scariness of what's happening inside of our heads and hearts. And then I agree that the buddy system is incredible. I have two people that, like, we have a code that all we have to do is text it to each other, and that's a, like, call me now. And then I have a friend that, like, when we are having certain thoughts, we tell each other just so that we have a witness for those thoughts. And I think just finding someone in your life to have that with, no matter, you know, is just a really great thing to try to sort of set up, no matter what the scenario is. I think relationships and community and just, yeah, talking about feelings are mentionable and manageable. I think I'm quoting that correctly, but if not, I like those words together. Yeah, that just talking doesn't have to be as scary as inside in our heads we might think it is.
I mean, for me, I deal with this on a daily basis with my staff and understanding kind of when they need attention. And I think we take a lot of time to get to know the people that work with us. And I'm fortunate that I get to spend a lot of time, especially in the kitchen, but really understanding the different personalities. And often, especially people in the kitchen, are not going to tell you their feelings, and they're very good at hiding behind a knife and a pan. And so I think understanding when you really need to check in with people and give them attention as a boss and a leader.
I would just echo all of that. Yeah, talking about feeling. I mean, I built a whole project around talking about loneliness. So, like, I mean, but like, I'm someone who's pretty unashamed to talk about her feelings. So I feel like that show could have been the anger hour or the desire hour or the whatever. It just happened to me. I happened to study loneliness. But yeah, it's important to talk openly about it. And that helps kind of neutralize the taboo around it.
Yeah, if you haven't listened to her podcast, it's called The Lonely Hour, and it's so, oh God, those
Kat are was a guest on season one. Thank you for coming when it was small.
Well, thank you. Like, it's such good voices to have in your head. is the lovely Julia and her guests and the conversations that flow out of that. It's a truly beautiful thing and a great act of self-care too.
It's a show about loneliness, but it's not a bummer, I promise.
No, it's warm and lovely. Do we have any other questions? Or I think some of us are, oh, there's one right over there. Oh wait, microphone is coming to you. Sorry. Well done.
It may sound a little strange, but I find myself, if I walk into a restaurant, I walk in and I'm thinking, what am I looking for? And I find myself looking to find something that's going to go wrong. Yeah. For me, cooking is an art. It's not just cooking and you eating and you forget about it. So I gave it up a long time ago, but I find myself, and it annoys my son and my daughter, that I'll walk into a restaurant, and instead of saying I'm going to have a good meal, I'm looking for something to criticize. I'm a critic. What causes that?
Only in restaurants, or do you and approach, you know, other things in
no,
life as well?
The funny thing is it transitioned into my personal life. I find myself that I'll meet someone, and instead of enjoying the person, nice and everything, I'm looking for something to go bad so I can break it off. Yeah.
Happiness is an active choice. It's not the default. Like, you have to decide, like, you know what? I'm open to this. It's work sometimes, being happy. If it's not a passive thing. I mean, sometimes things are enjoyable and they're lovely and they wash over you, but you did the work to go to the restaurant, to pick the restaurant, to go to the restaurant, to decide who you were going to go with, all of these things. So some of that is on you, I think. And it's letting that open. I think there is a fear of, especially in restaurants, where people think, like, I'm not going to get my money's worth. I'm going to do this wrong. I'm going to, you know, something is going to happen. And I know there are a lot of people who look for something wrong because they think that they somehow they were more aware, they criticized it more. Something. Sometimes happiness, these things can be simple, and it's scary to let yourself like things because what if it doesn't happen the next time? If you can be present in that moment and just appreciate each of the things that are happening, even if they're not perfect, it begets happiness. I think, like, the more it's sort of like a muscle that you have to exercise, and you'll be able to lift more happiness the more you are determined to let that happen, I think.
Well, by the way, Jackie, I know you don't remember me, but
I know, yeah,
you do.
Well, I think our, if you choose to see it, a lot of media is mean. Television can be mean. Newspapers can be mean. Twitter is very mean. And so if that's, there's this, another person I quote in the book, it's Donald O'Hebb, was a neuropsychiatrist, and he penned the phrase, neurons that fire together, wire together. Our brains are, you know, firing and wiring and reproducing, and, you know, they're setting up patterns. And so if we are looking at negative things over and over, we are creating negative patterns for ourselves, versus if we are looking at happy things and surrounding ourselves with happy things and creating happy patterns for ourselves. So I don't know what kind of, you know, media and things you have around in your life, but I think a lot of us, we have Yelp and we have Twitter and we have all these things that make all of us critics all the time. And so if we are filling our lives with that, that might lead us to be more critical when we walk into a place. Anybody can be a food critic right now. So I think, yeah, you have to actively choose to not be that. Happiness and gentleness and kindness, you have to choose to be present with an experience and look at, like, hey, I get to be in this amazing restaurant or this film or this beautiful bookstore and just be with other humans who are also in this weird universe that we are all spinning around in for some weird reason. You know, like, I think, like, you have to choose what you are taking in these weird brains that we have in our heads, and just be aware that what all the stuff that we are seeing, our brains are absorbing without us realizing it half the time.
As a chef,
I guarantee you, my restaurants will make you happy, sir. Here's the deal. When I was a very young cook, and I started going out to eat, and I had many similar feelings, and it was a choice, and I chose a long time ago that unless it's like on the list and a bucket list place where I've been waiting to go for years, I really try and just go out to dinner and surround myself with people I like and enjoy the experience and not kind of worry about if it's the best food I've ever had or if it's the best drink I ever had or if the service is the best, because if I did that for the last 25 years, I would be really miserable. So I think it's just about allowing yourself, like Jacqueline said, to just enjoy it and enjoy the experience and not get so caught up in the minutiae of what it is.
Well, and if you can't, don't go to restaurants for a little while. I mean, you edited out some stuff. Just edit it out for a minute and then slowly add it back and see how it feels.
So I think in the spirit of self-care, go to her restaurants.
Listen except to her, for Missy's restaurant.
Listen to her podcast. Read her book. And do something really lovely for yourself tonight in addition to coming here. I mean, thank you for being here. Thank you for writing this book that brought us together. Thank you for the cocktails and the food and all of this good stuff. Go forth and be happy.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com, Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family and become a member. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.